Simply, that's too long. These meetings were very beneficial as I was getting a direct feedback from someone who was dealing with customers daily and who could objectively say what looked good. This constructive criticism was great for us both. I was designing pieces that were selling, and she was able to sell them fast at her store in Ireland. Find people who can give you advice about your company and products with a European directness, but do take all the advice mindfully. You are the owner of the company and the ultimate decision maker. Quitting creative projects. Sometimes the setup of the company takes so long that the business never actually starts. Enter Plastic Monarchy, the promising business with one issue. It never started. I met my former roommate John in a New York cafe. It was June. He was sitting by the floor-to-ceiling window, which was wide open. It was a perfect night to enjoy a glass of wine at the end of the day. "I quit," he said. I knew he hadn't been happy in a while working for a company as a paralegal, so I was perplexed as to how to respond. Then, judging by a relieved smile on his face, I decided that, "Great, I'm happy for you," was an appropriate answer. John was excited, telling me about his plans of starting a business. I could feel that initial unspoiled joy that every business owner experiences when an idea pops into his head and he's ready to execute it. I was happy with him. We were looking forward to daytime lunches in the outdoor cafes, which are abundant in New York City. I ended up not seeing John for more than 6 months. After reaching out, we decided to have lunch and catch up. I was eager to hear about his new idea development. "Here it is," he said, handing me a brand new, freshly letterpressed business card. It looked very unusual, thicker than the ordinary business card, with beautiful textured letters saying his name, all the contact info, and the mysterious name of Plastic Monarchy. I loved it all. The name, the logo, and the overall look of the card were conveying New York class with a touch of edge. It did look like a well-thought-out brand, and I was dying to find out more. He told me that he had the cards custom-made in one of the letterpress shops in the West Village. He shared that he was able to get the domain and that he decided to make the company an LLC, giving me all the reasons behind his choice. "That's great," I genuinely said. "So what is Plastic Monarchy?"
"Well, it's still to be determined," he said.
I looked at him with disappointment and disbelief. Plastic Monarchy sounded so promising. Too bad the business never started. Your turn. Reflect, discuss, journal. What causes you most discomfort professionally? What cushion do you need to design your dream career? Describe how your business could operate without the safety cushion. Draw or describe your company's operating system. Don't worry about the details, it's just a draft. Highlight the parts which are important. Creative career insight. You need a system to have a successful creative career, unless you want to continue having a creative hobby. 5. Making it, product business.
Anything certain has already been done. Jonathan Fields, Uncertainty.
There are many ways to structure a product business. It should fit the design of your life regardless of outside expectations and growth pressure. Once many entrepreneurs and employees join the race, their vision becomes so myopic that they don't realize they shouldn't be in it. I hope you'll discover and follow the path that's right for you. You'll read about running a wholesale and retail business, what's important to get pricing right, upselling, and different ways of managing your inventory. During the 14 years of running my jewelry business, Lucid New York, I have been exhibiting at trade shows in New York, San Francisco, and Paris. I flew all over the country, participating in retail shows. I opened pop-up locations and have sold online. The collections are handmade in New York, and I work with artisans from Thailand and with factories in Hong Kong. I'll be sharing what has worked for me and the mistakes I made to save you time, money, and energy. I hope that reading about different ways of running a product business will inspire you to step up and build a creative career you truly deserve. Successful product launch. Successful creators focus on making the product launch experience designed for their customers.
The days of self-congratulating during launches are gone. Products are treated as tools, carefully curated to match customers' needs. Nowadays, to get anyone to attend, events are designed to be helpful, fun, and rich in experiences. If the launch is all about the product and its creator telling his story, it's likely that not many will find it attractive. Few will want to listen to someone else's story unless it can directly serve them. Book launches happen differently now as well. Having a bookstore event announcing a book release is not enough. Not even Q&As with an author will help fill the empty rows. If your name is not J.K. Rowling, you better make sure your book launch is a fun night out with prizes or a how-to workshop serving your readers. Your story and your book, or any other product, should be introduced in the context of helping your customers improve their lives. The times when an artist worked in solitude on his creations, revealing them for the first time during a launch, have passed. Now the audience wants to be co-creators, co-actively giving input throughout the process. We want to go behind the scenes earlier, as soon as the idea pops in the creator's head. Experiencing the creative process live, while it's happening, is now the norm. If we consider buying something, we don't want to watch. We want to participate and have a say during the process of making it. A lot of successful entrepreneurs launch their products on Kickstarter, describing their creative process in detail. They ask for donations in exchange for prizes. John Lee Dumas launched the Freedom Journal on Kickstarter, raising over $500,000 from more than 7,000 backers. Kickstarter is a great way to test products and to produce them to order. It can be very time-consuming to execute a stellar Kickstarter campaign, but it is an efficient and inexpensive way to launch a product. Grouping products into collections. Slides get put into presentations. We alphabetize titles, organize books, and file documents. As buyers, we love seeing things arranged for us. If we walk into a store and products are not organized by color, category, and collection, we don't buy. Sales racks are exceptions because we browse through them expecting seeing a mess. We do the work of digging through the items in exchange for getting lower prices. If you present your creations in an unorganized way, you'll risk making your potential client feel overwhelmed, confused, and even slightly frustrated. When you own a product business, it's important to grasp the idea of arranging your products into collections. A collection includes products that are related to one another by at least one attribute. That common trait makes them look like they belong to the same group. That trait may be a color, style, or the season the product is intended to be used for. Clothing stores have professional attire, sleepwear, and casual wear carefully separated and displayed in different store areas. If all of this was mixed, it would be daunting to browse and find what we need. One of the mistakes young designers make is creating one piece of every design. It may be more exciting to make something completely different from the piece you've just made, but it may not be a good decision when you display your products. Even if you make one-of-a-kind pieces, there should be some kind of relation between them, because grouping will entice us to buy. We need to see the product context. For example, clothes are modeled on runways and displayed on mannequins to give us ideas how we can wear them. Visiting any craft show, you can immediately spot vendors who are unaware of the importance of displaying products in groups and collections. Their booths and tables lack order, and potential customers pass them by, moving on to the booths which may offer less appealing products, but that are organized in a way that makes sense to their eyes. Some creatives take the idea of grouping even further, attempting to sell whole groups to their customers. Jewelry designers started displaying multiple necklaces, bracelets, and rings together, calling this trend stacking, and convincing clients to purchase more than one item. Some painters display their work in series of three, claiming it'll make a better statement. Books are written and sold in a series. Creators offer us hard-to-refuse discounts for purchasing in bulk. Presentation is the product's resume, and it sparks our clients' imagination. It's how our pieces are seen and valued. Clients who see creations that are attractively styled are more tempted to make a purchase. You've already put a lot of effort and energy into making your products. Put the finishing touch on them by presenting them in the light they deserve. Joy of retail. We all love selling at retail prices because our markups are higher and we get paid right away. These benefits come at a cost. If we own a store, we need to pay rent and other operational expenses. To do it successfully, we need to keep changing displays, invest in marketing, and have a strong brand presence on social media. Customers need to be attracted to, rewarded, tended to, and contacted. They know that they pay a premium price for their retail experience, and they keep expecting more for it. They want a stylist, a problem solver, and someone with an excellent eye for aesthetics who can give them personalized advice. If you choose to have a store online, you forego costly rent payments, but you'll be competing in a fierce contest for eyeballs. To get noticed on the internet, you'll need to have a very strong branding and overall presence online. What you won't be spending on rent, you'll spend on online ads or on hiring a dedicated person to manage your online marketing activity. Your customers will like seeing you featured in the press, so sending samples to media influencers regularly is a must. Contacting bloggers for possible exposure, reaching out to podcasters, and writing articles on your store site is necessary to get noticed. You don't have to do it all, but your marketing efforts will determine how large your online reach will be. Every year, I open retail pop-up locations in high-traffic areas in New York City. I have been doing it for 12 years, and here is what I focus on to make these retail operations successful every year. Product. Over the years, I curated collections for gift buyers, the market I decided to focus on at these locations. I offer great, quality handmade and imported gifts at various price points so that my customer is able to find a jewelry piece for every woman on her list, herself included. Location. I choose to pay premium for central locations. For me, visibility is crucial. Crowds attract crowds, and being busy energizes my staff. Staff. I'm surrounded by upbeat, outgoing staff with great personalities. If I need to hire an additional person, I have a phone conversation and usually ask the potential hire to come and work a shift. Usually there are two people who are not a good fit before I find a match. It takes a lot of time and energy to train before I make a decision to hire, but having a person that fits is worth it. Being outgoing, dedicated, and having an eye for style is a must. Creating meaningful connections with customers is crucial. People who work for Lucid New York are devoted and spread positive energy throughout the team. I show my gratitude by offering them schedule flexibility and higher pay than other retail venues. PR and marketing. Extending presence of your store online is crucial. Sometimes it may take a customer more than just one store visit to purchase a product. A website is a reminder, a great marketing tool, and another opportunity to make a sale. Adding customers to your email list is a great way of staying in touch, suggesting items, and building loyalty. Having a boutique is a dream of many. You may choose to make it a lifestyle business by having a healthy perspective on growth and being satisfied with just enough. Not everyone is cut for or chooses to end up with a busy store or expand to multiple locations. That's okay. I truly hope that by now you have decided to design a life on your own terms and are immune to growth defined by others. Advantages of wholesale. By focusing your efforts on selling products wholesale, you are able to get a tremendous exposure. Small boutiques, department stores, and online stores may be placing orders, and your main concern will be fulfilling them. You may think that you won't be having fulfillment issues, but the quantities ordered may exceed your expectations. Most large orders may have a similar expected delivery date, and you may run into unforeseen issues preventing you from being on time. If your business is import-based, the supplier you work with can miss your production deadline because of unforeseen issues on his end. You may discover that the quality of an order is not up to your standards. If your products are handmade, your local supplier may be out of stock on certain material. Also, you may think you're ready to make any product quantity needed, but what if your potential client is a buyer for a department store and wants to order thousands of pieces at a significant discount? Not being able to fulfill orders is the most common problem that product businesses run into. When you attend a trade show where exhibitors display their product samples and take orders, there are rows of booths, some of them staffed by multiple people busy writing orders. These businesses come back every year, setting up larger booths and doing more business. Here are proven strategies to start off right in the wholesale business. Don't overpromise. Set realistic rules for your business and share them openly with your customers so that they know what to expect. Test. Offer your products at craft shows, smaller venues, and online to get reactions before you approach store owners and exhibit your collections at a trade show. The price of renting a booth for just a few days of a wholesale show is usually very high, so you want to show up with pieces that had been already tested. Their proven success will also increase your chances for reorders. Offer products that can be reproduced. Buyers are attracted to products which can be easily reproduced. If they see that pieces are selling, they want to quickly reorder them. They're counting on you being able to fulfill their orders on time. Set fair prices. If you decide to have low prices to attract more business, you may set yourself up for disappointment. You'll be putting in long hours to fulfill the orders, and if you won't make it worth your time, you may start resenting your customers and your business overall, not to mention running into cash flow problems. Keep in mind that store owners are counting on multiplying the wholesale prices by 2.5 when selling your products in their boutiques. If you think this is not the price you would pay at a store, then maybe those prices are not right for wholesale distribution. You may have to consider tweaking the production process or cost of materials to make it worthwhile for everyone. Keep in mind, there are also shipping and fulfillment costs involved. Pay attention to cash flow. You'll be often asked for payment terms. Customers will try to receive your products and pay you 30 or 45 days later. If you are a brand new designer, you may be asked to sell on consignment, which will mean that you'll provide the pieces and get paid for them when they sell. Selling on consignment and offering payment terms may be a huge money burden for your business. That 30 or 45 day gap between shipping and getting paid is one of the main causes why most small businesses fail. There may be a lot of money tied in these shipped orders, and rent and other bills are due sooner than the payment is collected. These businesses run out of cash. Be mindful about it and set your payment rules accordingly. Systemize. Store owners love systems. At shows, they'll expect to see your products with well-marked style numbers and prices, which then will be arranged into a line sheet or a catalog. Their orders will be shipped to them the same way and take the same amount of time to process. Wholesale customers are often overwhelmed managing their boutiques, so it's important to make working with you easy. Think long-term. Wholesale profit margins are low, so to be successful, you have to focus on increasing quantities sold, which can be achieved by customer retention, reorders, and new customer acquisition. Don't compete with your customers. Having a website where you sell may be frowned upon by your clients because they don't want you to compete with them. They'd rather see you showing your collections online and listing their store as a place to buy the products. If you decide to sell online, do make sure you will be displaying the prices comparable to the ones offered by your clients by multiplying your wholesale prices by 2.5. Don't drop small accounts. When you start working with department stores and other large accounts, you may be tempted to stop working with boutiques that place non-consistent small orders. Don't make this mistake. These small orders are what Anderson calls the long tail. They may add up to more than the sum of your rock star clients. In the euphoria of abundance, you may not realize that department stores you sell to may one day stop placing orders. There's no guarantee that a client will be working with you indefinitely, and you should protect yourself and your business well-being by diversifying the clients you work with. Wholesale success is based on being reliable. The key is not only offering successful products, but also creating logistics, which will make working with you seamless. Exhibiting at trade shows, where you usually acquire most of your wholesale customers, is very pricey. So the goal is to make sure there will be reorders. Creating competitive products that sell and being able to deliver them as promised is key to thriving at selling wholesale. One-of-a-kind versus production process and exporting. A lot of customers do appreciate one-of-a-kind pieces, and it's possible to base your business around originality and uniqueness. Crucial thing to remember when offering one-offs is charging high prices. Production costs of making one-of-a-kind designs are high because you have to account for the time of the setup of making each piece. If every piece is unique, so is the production preparation and the making process itself. Sometimes, coming up with original designs but producing multiple pieces of each is a more cost-efficient strategy. You can have best of both worlds, offering unique pieces and taking advantage of efficient production methods. If you sell a one-of-a-kind piece and you get a referral from your customer who may want to purchase the same piece, you may lose a sale if you're not able to recreate it. Also, if you don't produce multiple pieces, it's difficult to get involved in wholesale because store owners like ordering in bulk and reordering the pieces that sell. If your pieces are one-of-a-kind, you'd work with museums and collectors and make pieces to order. Once you get into reproducing your pieces, you'll be able to offer lower prices. There will also be decisions to make around who will be producing the pieces. Is it going to be you? Will you hire someone locally or get it produced overseas? Producing overseas offers low pricing. Here are important things to remember when considering importing. You need to get the prototype made of the pieces you want to order. Providing samples instead of explaining in detail will minimize the chances of errors. Leave yourself plenty of time to get samples produced, as you'll likely be revising and refining. There may be a language barrier. You may have to adjust your work times to a different time zone, unless you don't mind waiting a day between emails. You may have to order a large quantity of each style to get the low price. Please note that the minimum order quantity, MOQ, required, the per-piece price can always be negotiated. Would you like to explore the exporting option and domestic production deeper? Log on to www.annasabino.com for an ultimate A to Z guide to getting your products made. Upselling. The difference between a sales clerk and a sales professional is willingness to take an extra step to understand and help the customer. It's removing yourself from the equation and redirecting the spotlight on the client and his needs. Sales clerks may not suggest complimentary items because this is not how they themselves shop. Sales professionals, however, will work with every customer differently depending on her needs. When we go to a store and purchase a top or a skirt, we usually are open to being suggested additional items. Sometimes we need to buy a belt or a pair of earrings to check that mental box of, now I'm all set. And speaking of all, asking, is this all you need? Is probably the most unappealing question to ask in sales. The customer doesn't know the answer, and by asking it, you shut her down and shut down additional sales opportunities, making the whole sales experience incomplete and unpleasant. But let's go back to upselling, an expression used in sales when we suggest an additional item matching the one a customer is already purchasing. Buying something in addition to what she needs reassures her that she made a good decision. Customers like feeling reassured about their purchases. If they buy a second or third item, it makes them feel that they were right in the first place. Notice shoppers on busy streets in metropolitan areas and in malls. They rarely carry only one shopping bag. Just like we watch movies one after another, we may feel like purchasing multiple items. You're not being pushy by suggesting matching items. You're being helpful and open to making additional sales. Connecting meaningfully. Certain questions, especially the yes-no ones, don't work well in sales. They're not engaging and usually boring. Here are some of the most predictable ones. Do you need anything else? The customer doesn't know if he needs anything else. It's up to us to make him realize what he needs. Most sales happen through impulse. Clients end up buying a product or two without previously intending. They didn't know they needed it, and neither did they know if they needed anything else. Consider continuing the conversation and letting the customer tell you whether he is all set or if he needs anything else. Is it going to be cash or charge? This is personally my least favorite question to ask me when I shop. I dislike it because it doesn't serve any purpose. What's going to happen if my answer is cash? You'll take my cash and give me change. What is going to change if I say charge? You'll take my card and swipe it. Both transactions can be done effortlessly nowadays. Consider being helpful instead. This is usually the moment when the customer is still thinking about the purchase. She may be still deciding about the additional item, or she may still feel unsure about the purchase she's making. Help her deal with buyer's remorse by reassuring her about the current purchase, or chat with her about the item she decided to forego. She may feel better about the current item, change her mind and buy the additional one, or come back another time. Can I help you? What bothers me most about this generic question is that it's very vague. Consider engaging in a more creative way by tying in what you noticed about the customer. You may start a conversation noticing what he was browsing at the store, making a comment about what he is wearing and suggesting something complimentary, or starting a friendly small talk. Making a sale is a delicate process. Looking at making sales from a psychological point of view, we meet someone who came to our store with a pack of emotions. It's important to be mindful and helpful. By engaging in a meaningful way, we can make a deeper connection, which can extend way beyond sales. That bond may transform a stranger into a devoted customer and fan who will become your brand evangelist. She may be visiting your store on multiple occasions, ordering from you when she needs gifts and talking about you to her family and friends, convincing them to purchase your pieces. Because we all know how powerful word of mouth is, why don't we commit to using meaningful questions and engaging in meaningful conversations? It'll be more genuine and helpful. Inventory management, a lesson learned from a Sri Lankan coconut picker. Every day, I'd ask for a coconut at a snack shop by the guest house in Sri Lanka where I was staying. And every day, I'd get the same question. 20 minutes, okay? I didn't mind the wait, but one day I felt the urge to ask why. Then I found out the process of fulfilling my orders. Every day after I ordered a coconut, the server would ask his helper to climb up the tree and get it. Now that's just-in-time inventory management. The advantage of this system was that every piece was sold and the shop didn't need to store the coconuts. It worked to fulfill the orders of the snack shop, but if the owner wanted to open another location or supply the coconuts to another company, he'll have to change the inventory management system. When you own a product business, you face a dilemma of production process and inventory management. It comes down to deciding if you'll be making things to order locally, importing large quantities, or implementing the combination of both strategies. These systems have their advantages and disadvantages. When you produce locally, the trouble may arise when you get an unusually large order. You may run into last-minute problems caused by your material suppliers, staff issues, or your personal problems. Not having enough pieces and not being able to fulfill the orders on time may result in losing opportunities and appearing not trustworthy. However, making pieces just in time has a tremendous benefit because we are mitigating the risk of having unsold inventory, which is a substantial loss to a business. Importing, on the other hand, involves investing in purchasing large quantities of products and storing them. Usually, suppliers require us to purchase at least 40 to 60 pieces of every style. Lower quantity would not be worth producing and shipping internationally. You have to be logistically ready to handle the shipment by having a place to store it. When you import, the unit price is low, but the lead time, the time between the initiation and completion of a production process, is long, taking usually 60 to 90 days. Communication may be challenging because of a language barrier, and there's a risk of low product quality. Gift business. Crucial attributes of a gift. Gifts account for a large part of most businesses' sales. There are so many personal gift-giving occasions in our lives, as well as the holidays created by Hallmark, that whether we run a product or a service business, we can't afford not to sell gifts. We need to understand the thought process behind these purchases. The two most important feelings we want to convey when selling a gift is reassurance that our clients made a good choice and that it's a safe choice. For an object to be coveted, it should look and feel personalized. A personalized gift makes us feel special. It shows us that the person who bought it put some thought into it and spent time choosing it. Often, someone searching for a perfect gift has an idea based on knowing the person, her preferences, hobbies, feelings, or the relationship they have. Sometimes they look for something specific, something to match another piece they own, or something within a budget. I still recall a gentleman coming into our Lucid New York jewelry pop-up store asking if we carried anything for $300. Without asking him what exactly he had in mind, I showed him a jewelry set for $300, explaining what it was made of. He bought it without looking at other pieces and comparing. Done deal. In his mind, spending this amount was going to increase his chance of succeeding at buying the perfect gift. One of the best lines that we can say to someone looking for a gift is not that it's a good value, but that it's a safe choice. By affirming that something is the best seller or that it's a one-of-a-kind piece, all we're communicating is that the gift is a safe purchase, that the receiving person will like it. The customer will go far to be reassured about the gift. He'd probably pay a higher-than-intended price for it because, to him, a premium paid for feeling reassured that he made a good choice is a premium well spent. Making the extra effort so that the customer feels better about his choice goes far. Adding complimentary accessories to the product or offering extended return policy will extend the customer's loyalty. Putting time and effort into helping someone choose a personalized gift will benefit you on many levels. If a man got a gift made or recommended by you and it made his wife happy, you're likely to see him again. His decision got approved, he got validated, and he'll want more of it. He'll value your recommendations and consider you a gift expert. You will be a go-to person for future gifts for his wife and possibly for his mother and his coworkers. He'll also tell his friends about the great choice he made thanks to your advice. You'll not only gain a repeat customer, but also a fan. Bootstrapping versus being funded. Many entrepreneurs believe that looking for funding is a necessary step when starting a business. Being funded comes with its territory. You, as a business owner, are basically agreeing to involve someone who will always have a say in your business. Depending on compatibility of your personalities and visions, it can be beneficial or detrimental. The circumstances can always change, and people can too, and you're signing up to accept it. Of course, you're getting a prize for it, being funded, but you'd better know how to use it. It may seem odd to question the ability to spend money, but not in the context of the overall company goal. First, there's a pressure of investing it correctly. Investors and venture capitalists give you money because they believe you'll make it worth it. They want you to at least match their expected rate of return, and they want you to do it fast. This pressure could be crippling or motivating. To be brief, being funded works if you have a plan and if you're fine with taking directions and being held accountable. You don't need to get funding to start a business. When you grow your business organically, bootstrap your business, you reinvest the profits you make back into the business, making the money work creatively for you. You do it on your own terms and at your own pace. This can be very motivating, and when done well, you can achieve growth very fast, or better yet, however fast you want. When growing organically, it's important to keep your business lean. More about that in Chapter 7. By obsessively controlling the expenses and focusing on profits. It may be more beneficial to focus on profit than increasing the quantity of pieces sold. With volume increase comes fulfillment and storage costs. You'll need to respond to more customer inquiries and troubleshoot more problems. Logistics become more convoluted and fixed costs increase, which leaves you with fewer resources to reinvest in the business. Bootstrapping works best with star products, pieces people want more of that are fast and easy to sell at a nice profit. It's best if these pieces are accompanied by beautiful brand visuals, the packaging and logo, for example, and great service. This combination of good presentation and ensuring customer satisfaction will boost your marketing. By creating these star products, before you know it, your devoted army of customers will be spreading the word for you. Accessorizing the giants. Many entrepreneurs think how to invent the next iPhone, write the next Harry Potter book, or release the next Rubik's Cube. They keep wondering what would have happened if they were the one who had invented one of the best-selling products of all time. They obsessively follow the inventor's career path, trying to mimic him and living vicariously through him. They are envious of these star products. Sometimes their single focus pushes them as far as copying the original idea. What if this destructive envy got replaced with inspiring envy? What if we treated these already popular products as a platform for us to build on? Once a business owner realizes that it's a less risky position to be in, he'll drastically increase his chances of succeeding. The follower's road is paved, tested, and cushioned. Attach yourself to people and organizations who are already successful, and subsume your identity into theirs and move both forward simultaneously. Ryan Holiday, Ego is the Enemy. Many smart entrepreneurs are taking advantage and create accessories to go with the product giants. These add-ons are associated right away, without any marketing efforts, with something successful. Let's take as an example some of the most successful Etsy stores in 2017 so far. Scribble Prints Co., Sweet Kawaii Design, and Once More with Love are all capitalizing on the creative journaling trend, selling stickers, notepads, inserts, and other accessories for the famous Erin Condren planners. A few years ago, these successful Etsy stores, processing over 700 transactions daily, noticed the $40 million stationery company and decided to come up with sticker sheets targeting thousands of devoted fans of the Life Planners and other similar journals that have since appeared on the market. Why wouldn't more entrepreneurs focus on accessorizing the giants instead of chasing the spotlight and always wanting to be the giants? Inventing something brand new is not necessarily the most lucrative approach, though we often crave being the first to do something. However, we can still lead within our own categories and be one of a kind in our own niche. On making glass hammers, octopus rings, and other things unlikely to sell. I have taken a lot of jewelry design classes in my life, and I kept making the same observation. Artists more talented than I were often not successful, sometimes even having a hard time supporting themselves. They were all pursuing their passion, creating what they loved. If all they needed was one customer, themselves, they'd definitely succeed. They loved what they were making to the point that it was often very hard for them to part with certain pieces. I remember there was a woman making glass hammers at the Brooklyn Glass Studio I used to work from. The pieces were intricate and time-consuming to make. She would make them one by one to create a collection for an exhibit. She wasn't yet known in the fine art world. What will happen to the hammers after the exhibit? They'd likely end up in the artist's home. They'd be difficult to sell. She had chosen a very risky path. If your true love is fine art, but you don't have an established name for yourself yet, consider creating some utilitarian art as well to balance your inventory. Maybe you can make pieces that are a mélange of the two or two separate collections. One with the pieces that are easier to sell and will secure income, and another one with the work that you're truly passionate about. By diversifying, you might mitigate risks. Another example is a very talented wax carving artist. Lost wax is a technique of creating detailed designs out of wax by carving it using different tools. It takes years to master it, as any imperfection in the wax shows on the piece after it had been cast in metal. This woman had it. Her wax designs looked like beautiful tiny sculptures carved with amazing attention to detail. She also had a hard time making it as a jewelry designer. Having a closer look at the rings she carved, you could see a beautiful octopus ring with all the tentacles carved carefully, wrapping around the finger. A true work of art that had probably taken her days to create. Then there was a ring with a horse head. It may sound blunt, but I have yet to see someone wanting and wearing an octopus ring, no matter how meticulously it had been made. Women don't usually buy octopus rings. The majority like buying pretty jewelry that makes them look good. Delicate lucky charms, such as horseshoes, clovers, wishbones, hearts, seahorses, starfish, and such sell. Octopus doesn't sell. I'm, of course, generalizing here. With some effort and determination, you may be able to find a few customers for horsehead rings, but the same effort and determination could be used to successfully sell 500 horseshoe necklaces. Do follow your passion, but it's critical to make sure that your passion aligns with what the customers want. Starting a business and being an entrepreneur is risky enough in itself, so try and mitigate the other risks by doing some research in your field and finding out what people like. Your turn. Reflect, discuss, journal. How will you let your audience witness your product-making process? How will you group your products into collections? What are the ways you could upsell your products? Will you be making pieces to order, having them made locally, or exporting? How will you manage your inventory? Creative career insight. Don't celebrate when you get a brilliant idea. Celebrate when you brilliantly execute it. 6. Following your passion versus providing what people want. Creativity is the way I share my soul with the world. Brené Brown, Rising Strong. Make good art, said Neil Gaiman in his 2012 commencement speech at the University of the Arts. The author gave a lot of situational examples, some of them are really humorous, but all of them leading to the necessity of creating good art. He said, I'm serious. Husband runs off with a politician? Make good art. Leg crushed and then eaten by mutated boa constrictor? Make good art. IRS on your trail? Make good art. Cat exploded? Make good art. Somebody on the internet thinks what you do is stupid or evil, or it's all been done before? Make good art. Probably things will work out somehow, and eventually, time will take the sting away. But that doesn't matter. Do what only you do best. Make good art. Make it on the good days, too. We've talked about creating systems for our creative business, and in Chapter 11, we'll be exploring different ways of marketing and PR. But none of these proven business strategies will work if there's not a solid platform, a successful product. When we create a successful product, our satisfied customers do the marketing for us. They want to take the social credit for a great recommendation to their friends. Moreover, when their friends buy the same product, it'll reassure them about the purchase, and everybody is happy. So all you have to do is make good art. Good art is not art that looks good to you. Actually, if you haven't sensed it yet, when you own a business, it's not about you or your art. It's about your customers and their needs. Creatives who understand that become successful. What makes your art and your products good are the customers who not only admire them, but who are also willing to pay for them. Redirecting the spotlight. Behind every brand, there's a founder's story, your story, the beginnings, the struggle that have led you to where you are now. You know that the audience wants to know your story, but if you don't share it in context, you're risking widening the gap between you and your audience. Dim your spotlight, or better yet, redirect all the lights on them, the people who came to see how you can help them. How can you curate your story so that it's relevant to the stories of people who came to see you? They came to listen to you because you're perceived as an expert. But don't adopt a goddess attitude. Don't widen the gap between your audience and you by applauding yourself. Imagine stepping down the podium and sitting with your audience. How would your voice, your delivery change? This is what they want. They want you to share your story in the context of theirs. Instead of sharing how good you are, let them know how good they may become with your guidance. Did you notice that most best-selling memoirs are funny? Share funny personal anecdotes with your audience. Champion them for showing up. Show your customers how smart they are. Make them realize what's possible. On stage, in your interactions on social media, and when seeing your clients face-to-face, present your story in the context of your customers, who came to see you to get their problems solved. It's not only about you and your passion. If you write a mission statement of your company and I is mentioned in it too many times, remove it. It's not about you. It's about your customers. I've seen so many business plans where owners describe their experience, how they came up with the idea for the business, and how enriching the whole journey has been for them. If your client was your mother, this business plan would be perfect. But assuming that you want to go broader and target more customers than just your mom, you have to understand and come to terms with one important thing. It's not about you. Your goal is to show to your potential customers how your products can benefit them. Imagine a jewelry designer trying to sell a beautiful sunrise shell necklace to a woman who is trying it on. While she's putting it on, the creator tells the story of how she came up with the idea. She describes the little beach in Hawaii that inspired her and the special place where she was able to get the shell. The customer will listen, but she may not be that attentive, because this whole time she'll be thinking about the clothes she'll wear with the piece, if the color flatters her skin, and if the necklace is the right length for her. Don't get me wrong, it's nice that she heard the story, but your story will not make her buy the piece. She will only buy the piece if she likes it. Successful entrepreneurs shorten or skip their stories to paint a picture of how the product will benefit their customers. Because we spend so much time engaged in different aspects of our business, we need to make sure we like its essence or we are not going to have the right attitude necessary to succeed. Doing what serves our customers is not enough. We also have to like it or our business won't be sustainable. It's our creative why that's behind the liking it. The stronger the why, the reason for being in the business, the more successful we'll be. Finding the crossover of our passion and what customers want is what most successful entrepreneurs strive for. You, the sample of one. It's risky to rely on only your expertise when creating and releasing products. You may have been in business for a long time and have studied the market, but no matter how savvy, you're still just one person. Blindfolded by this terrific idea of yours, you may not realize that you are just the sample of one. One person liking your products. Falling in love with your products and business is dangerous. It's important to take a step back and answer the question, are people going to like what I make? It's time to move on from celebrating you and your company and get to the core of research and development to create a successful business. Not every opinion should matter because your pieces are not for everyone. Marketing experts can give you limited advice. It's the feedback of your target market, people for who you're creating, that you should most value. End users may give you the most unpredictable reactions. They may inform you that they see a different use for your product. Don't convince or explain how things are supposed to be used. It's for them to decide how your pieces will serve them. Don't get discouraged when feedback is not what you expected. You may be too in love with your products to make rational decisions, but know that those who succeed are able to remove their ego from the process. They create and keep making iterations based on the continuous feedback they receive from those who the products are designed for. Social currency. Social currency is the connection between the brand and consumers. It's all the links, pictures, and shares which we post to make others laugh, inform our followers, and be perceived as an authority on a topic. We endorse a product by showing it to our friends and spreading a message about it on social media. If we feel strongly about it, we may even try to convince our friends to buy it by presenting the product's value, demonstrating its features, and letting them know how it'll benefit them. Companies may build social currency and entice customers to share their message, but ultimately it depends on the customers to choose what information they'll spread. We are selective about what we share because we want our friends to continue trusting our opinion. It's important for us to keep the expert status and keep being asked for recommendations and opinions. This makes us feel important and feeds our ego. Depending on our feelings toward the product, we may become fans, joining fan pages, groups, and launch teams without expecting any compensation in return. We choose this role of an unpaid product evangelist to make ourselves feel better about our purchase and to give back for our priceless feeling of satisfaction. We may feel the need to reciprocate. The happier we feel about our purchase, the stronger our need to share and spread the message. Every year, thousands of happy customers come back to the Lucid New York holiday pop-up locations to buy more gifts. They often bring their friends with whom they share the Lucid message. They often brag about how much social currency they've accumulated, expecting to get some customer points. What's interesting is that I rarely ask them to do that. They take on the jewelry evangelist role themselves and get to action. I facilitate their efforts by always including a business card and a pouch with a logo with every purchase. But what influences their involvement and sharing most is that they truly loved Lucid New York jewelry. Sometimes they come wearing the jewelry a year later, letting me know how happy they are with its quality. If there are other customers around, they give them their evangelist speech. All this without being asked to do it. Creating familiar surprise. Some creatives are all about making one-of-a-kind pieces to surprise us with their novelty. Their obsession with inventing makes them insensitive to their clients' needs, who do like being surprised, but who also crave the familiar. Most of us know the idea of an acquired taste, such as when we start liking a food later on in life, or after having tried it multiple times. We start liking songs, names, and other things after being exposed to them numerous times. The trick is learning to frame your new ideas as tweaks of old ideas, to mix a little fluency with a little disfluency, to make your audience see the familiarity behind the surprise. Derek Thompson, Hitmakers. This mere exposure effect is a concept first defined by Robert Zajonc. It's a psychological phenomenon by which we develop a preference for things simply because we are familiar with them. This is the reason why, in pitches of original concepts, new ideas are compared to the already familiar, successful ones. Airbnb was presented as eBay for homes. And now, new concepts based on shared economy are the Airbnb of, or the Uber of. The familiar may evoke in us the feeling of nostalgia and comfort, whereas novelty, as appealing as it may sound, may not be welcomed by those who don't like unfamiliar or are risk-averse. We're excited about novelty less than we think we are. We're more likely to be into novel spins on the familiar instead of breakthrough concepts. We love hearing that an item is a bestseller or that a company has had a long tradition, which suggests familiarity and trust. Adam Grant, in Originals, explains that exposure increases the ease of processing. A familiar idea requires less effort to understand, and it makes us feel comfortable. This is yet another reason for us creatives to be sharing our creative process from the early stages, instead of making products in solitude and having a big reveal. The launch of a kept-secret product may not match the expected excitement of the creator. The product will be new and unfamiliar, and we may need some time to start liking it. Smart application of simple. Most budding entrepreneurs think that starting a business involves coming up with very intricate products or solutions, which involve specialized talent and expertise. They back this up by saying that if it was easy, everyone would own a business. They don't realize that in most cases, it's not the simple that sells, but it's the smart application of simple. Clean, straight lines are in, and less is more has been holding true more than ever. Feeling overwhelmed by work and life, we want simple, easy, and light. Zero down and no contract lure in our non-committal society. The times of manuals are over, and now everything self-explanatory and user-friendly appeals to us. We want to save time and gain space. Books about minimizing and organizing are in. We want to do more with less. We crave the white space, the place where our minds can rest uninterrupted for at least a little time in our days, because living mindfully and living with less became the lifestyle we now desire. We're also attracted to less intricate products with clean lines, which project simplicity and calm. Simplicity takes work, says Ken Segal in his book, Think Simple. Simple designs, which look like they were created effortlessly, had probably taken more time to come into existence than the more complicated ones. Simplicity is what made Apple start thriving again and made us wait in lines for new versions of the iPhone, which, by the way, has never come with a manual. I started Lucid New York jewelry brand by putting single charms on chains. Many people probably thought that anyone could do it. I found the charms and put them on chains. Two seemingly simple actions my customers didn't want to do. They wanted ready-to-wear charm necklaces, and they were willing to pay for them. Ignoring those who were saying that what I was doing was simple and others saying that charm necklaces had been done before, Lucid New York kept thriving in its simple way, propelled by the fad of layering those simple necklaces. Full solution. Seth Godin, in his blog post, Think About Parsley, described his disappointing experience of having breakfast at one of the diners in New York. In his humorous article, he complained his meal didn't come with any garnish, which made him feel ripped off. We want that slice of a strawberry or orange or even a piece of parsley. We usually don't eat the garnish, and yet we notice when it's not there. The garnish makes the meal look finished, showing that the chef pays attention to details. Customers take it beyond the garnish. They want the full solution. Brands listen. They spoil them by delivering more value. They have the power to demand it. We assume that the gift we buy can be wrapped. Cars and other appliances come with free warranty, which we extend indefinitely, living by the words that customer is always right. We become overloaded. Choice no longer liberates. It debilitates. It may even be said to tyrannize. Barry Schwartz, The Paradox of Choice. I once got an email from a customer with a complaint that her necklace tarnished. When I asked her when she bought it, she said it was about 5 years ago, and added that it stayed in good condition until she swam in a lake wearing it. You may wonder what I did. I could have gone back and forth trying to prove that she was in the wrong, but I chose to send her a new necklace. My generosity paid off. She became my devoted fan, spreading the word about Lucid New York jewelry. She ended up buying more pieces, and so did her friends, who she personally kept bringing to my New York holiday pop-up shop. Wanting full solutions through the products and services we buy, we are willing to stretch our budgets and pay more. We buy accessories and other add-ons to get a full experience. Basic options rarely sell because we crave more functions, which we probably won't use, but we do crave them. We want a turnkey solution, reasoning that our time is worth money. This full solution attitude offers a broad variety of options for business owners if we know how to take advantage of it. We now sell series and subscriptions, full outfits and items in different colors, packaged together as if they belonged. The free bow is included. Our credit card gets charged recurring payments, which we consciously agreed to because we received 2 free months. As creatives, we need to consider full solutions that offer bundles, series, and collections, remembering to include a discount and a free bow, because this is expected in today's world overflowing with options. Options and decision paralysis. If you ask, most customers will tell you that they want to have many options. They think that they want to see everything available and choose for themselves. None of this is true. Do you remember the time when you went shopping and after seeing a lot of options, you left empty-handed because you simply couldn't decide? Well, you're not alone. It's a common phenomenon. There's even a term for it. Decision paralysis. More options, even if they're good ones, can freeze our actions and pull us in the direction of the status quo, where we don't have to make decisions. Deciding not to decide is the safest, and thus our favorite, option. Barry Schwartz, in The Paradox of Choice, analyzes the decision-making process, concluding that the abundance of choices available to us doesn't provide freedom and independence, but stress and discomfort. There are steps you can take to satisfy instead of stress our customers. Create a friendly environment for making decisions by presenting your products in an organized way. Narrow options for your customers by suggesting a few products for them based on their needs. Do not make the mistake of showing everything that you have available to everyone. You will risk creating a stressful environment, which they'll be tempted to leave without buying anything. Show less products. You may be tempted to efficiently utilize the space in your store by displaying a lot of products or cramming your catalog pages with as many SKUs as you can fit, but this may only overwhelm your customers. Instead of impressed, they will feel stressed. Create less options. Instead of offering pieces in a multitude of colors, opt for the ones that you think your customers will like, considering going for a few safe colors, the ones which are always popular, and a trendy or unusual color, which can spice up your display and provide an option for the customers who are more outgoing with their choices. Tie into the familiar. If you are presenting a new concept, compare it to an already existing one so that it's easier for your customers to grasp it. Every jewelry company makes circle necklaces. Some creatives try to set trends, and others follow the popular and familiar. Setting trends is easier if you are a celebrity or have a large following of devoted fans who are ready to buy what you sell. Many new entrepreneurs create a product that they fall in love with and take on the challenge to introduce it to the market. In most cases, the idea is based on the owner's conviction that it'll work. Unfortunately, this is usually not enough for the product to succeed. Creatives who choose to study trends and let them dictate their creative direction set themselves up for a safer path to success. More than 20 years ago, G.T. Dave created